The secret sauce of Amazon, where there are several principles at Amazon, but the number one thing that has made us successful by far is obsessive compulsive focus on the customer as opposed to obsession over the competitor. And I talk so often to other CEOs and some other CEOs and also founders and entrepreneurs, and I can tell that even though they're talking about customers, they're really focusing on competitors. And it is a huge advantage to any company if you can stay focused on your customer instead of your competitor. So then you have to identify who is your customer. So at the Washington Post, for example, is the customer the people who buy advertisements from us? No, the customer is the reader. Full stop, the customer is the reader. And then, by the way, where do advertisers want to be? Advertisers want to be where there are readers. So it's really not that complicated. You know, it comes around really well. And in the school, who are the customers? Is it the parents? Is it the teachers? No. It is the child. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to be obsessively, compulsively focused on the child. We're going to be scientific when we can be. And we're going to use heart and intuition when we need to.
Hey, it's Evan Carmichael, and this channel was created to help you overcome the number one challenge that is holding you back, a lack of belief in yourself. You watch these videos because you know you've got something more inside you. You've got Michael Jordan-level genius at something. So today, let's live your best belief life and learn how you can guarantee success for your life. Enjoy. Rule number two, invest in yourself first with Warren Buffett.
By far the best investment you can make is in yourself. I mean, for example, communication skills. I tell the students that come that they're going to graduate schools and business and they're learning all these complicated formulas and all that. If they just learn to communicate better, and both in writing and in person, they increase their value at least 50%. And, you know, I mean, if you can't communicate, somebody says, you know, it's like winking at a girl in the dark. Nothing happens, you know, basically. And you have to be able to get forth your ideas, and that's relatively easy. I did it myself with the Dale Carnegie course. Some people wish I'd taken a shorter course now in terms of my talking later on, but it's just hugely important. And if you invest in yourself, nobody can take it away from you.
Rule number three, get attention with Grant Cardone.
You better get excited now, because if you're not going to get excited now, nobody will give you this money. Nobody will give you this money. Money follows attention. How much attention can I get in the marketplace is where money goes. Money does not go to the best product, ever. Money does not go to the best product. Money does not go to the happiest place either. Money goes to where attention goes. Whoever gets the most attention gets the most money. Action, massive action, has always worked. It's proven itself for thousands of years. This is not a new concept. You show me somebody, and we know their name, anybody in the room, any famous person that you can think of, anybody, that we would both know. You say, I'm going to mention their name, and Grant will know who that is. Give me a name of one person.
Tiger Woods.
Massive action. Persistent massive action. Okay? How many people were watching the Open yesterday? Yeah, exactly. Why? Because Tiger was in it. Attention. Money follows attention. Money follows attention. How much attention can you get? Even bad attention. Okay? I'm going to tell you something. What Tiger went through in the last decade helped him. You got more white people pulling for Tiger Woods, right? They're like, Tiger, grown white men, Tiger. And we say there's division in this country. Tiger, I love Tiger. Right? Why? Because they love a comeback, man. The guy got a lot of attention. Okay, who else? Give me another name. Oh my God, I didn't know it was gonna be this kind of meeting. If I didn't know it was gonna be this kind of meeting, I'd charge you double.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump. Everybody knows him, okay? Money follows attention. Success and power follow attention. Okay, you cannot like the guy, but could you handle that much heat every day? Could you handle that many people not liking you every day? Because if you're going to be a leader, if you're going to be a real leader, okay, if you're going to be at the top of the food chain kind of leader, people aren't going to like you.
Also, to make sure you're actually taking action after watching this video, I've designed a special free worksheet just for this video. The worksheet will highlight all of the lessons learned in this video, as well as pull out our three favorite learnings and quotes that will inspire you to actually do something. The worksheet will also give you space to write down what your key takeaways are and your specific plan of action to make sure you're getting results. If you want the worksheet designed specifically for this video, absolutely for free, there's a link in the description below. Go click on it and start building the momentum in your life and your business. I'll see you there. Rule number four, focus on positivity with Peter Diamandis.
In that same year, I was the closing speaker for President Clinton at CGI. And at the end of his introduction, he said to me, "Peter, why are you so positive about the future? Don't you watch the news?" And I said, "President Clinton, with all due respect, no, I don't watch the news." And I look at the data. And so the reality is that as we humans were evolving on the savannas of Africa hundreds of thousands, millions of years ago, back then, if we missed a piece of negative news, like so rustling of the leaves is the wind and not a lion, you know, the negative news could put you out of your misery. And we developed an ancient piece for our temporal lobe called the amygdala, about the size of your thumb, that scans everything you see and everything you hear for negative news. And if you see it, it puts you on red alert. And it's not something we control. It's something deep wired into our brains. And at the end of the day, the news media uses this, right? The old adage, if it bleeds, it leads, is so true, right? If you ask yourself the question, you know, what's the news media's job? It's to deliver your eyeballs to their advertisers. That's it, pure and simple. And so if we're paying 10 times more attention to negative news than positive news, open up the newspaper tomorrow morning and just count the number of negative stories to positive stories. It's extraordinary. It's 10 to 1. I mean, do the experiment. And it's not that they're, you know, masochistic or that they want to just, you know, have a negative mindset. It's their business. They don't show you all the other amazing news going on in the world every single day. And so I choose not to watch the news. I mean, period. I get back 2 hours a day. It's amazing. My social network will tell me what I need to know. My family will. My friends will. There's nothing I don't miss. I have Google alerts for my companies and the things that I care about. But allowing, you know, the Crisis News Network or Fox or whomever it might be to tell me what they think I should be learning, not what I want to do with my time.
Rule number five, be prepared to walk alone with Vusi Tembekweyo.
I grew up without. I suffered. I was told I'm worthless. Now that I have it, I'm going to show everybody. Because if they affirm to me that I am, then I must be. And it's not until you get to a stage where you realize the affirmation is not necessary, that you're truly free. So as you build your business, I'm telling you now that if it's the external affirmation you're looking for, you're going to sickle. You're not going to get it, guys. It's hard, like, and it's not unless you walk the journey, right? It's when you are in it that you're like, why don't they get it? Yeah, the world must be, they're losing their minds. Have you ever seen something that nobody else sees, but you know it's there because you can see it? You're like, nah, and you explain it, but they don't see it, right? And in that, the only thing that keeps you sane is if the only affirmation you need is you. So it's kind of counterintuitive, right? Quickly, before we start, I got to tell you this. I'll tell you why it's counterintuitive. Anthropologists and human science specialists both have studied prisons. Prisons are a fascinating thing, right? Because when you're a human being, what we do in this thing called a society, very careful of society, by the way, because society is nothing more than a system of normalized averages. So what it is we all come together and we go, well, for us, for there to be order in any system that can grow exponentially, ergo population growth, we need a system to manage it. And we're going to codify the system, and we're going to call these things good behavior, etiquette, rules, laws. If you break them, we're going to punish you. We have to do it, otherwise there'll be disorder. Like if nobody tells you, sit on the right-hand side of the car and drive on the left-hand side of the road, you're going to sit wherever you want, you're going to drive however you want. And we can't create a society like that. So what society does is it writes these rules, it codifies them, that create the average for the average. The average human being should be like this. That's why your mom says, go to school, get a good education, get a job, get a husband, have 2.5 kids, live in the White House with a picket fence. That's why you're told that, because your mother comes from a society with a system of normalized averages. And then you come up and go, nah, maybe not. Maybe I don't want to finish school. Or maybe I do, but I actually don't want to get a job. I actually want to go through 5 years of not knowing where my next meal is going to come from, because I've got a dream. The minute you break away from society's rules, it'll do exactly what they do to you in prison. So check this out. So you break the law, they send you to prison. Why? Because if we can remove you from broader society, we punish you. Yeah? Human beings, by their very nature, need interaction. This is a vital part of being a human being. When you're in prison and you break the rules, what do they do then? They put you in isolation. So just to be clear, to the strongest, toughest, most evil people of society, the single most powerful form of punishing them is separation. It's not physical punishment. It's, I'm going to put you in a hole, alone. That's it. And it will break you. That's why people don't have the courage to walk the path of entrepreneurship. Because the minute you're walking, you're going, holy shit, I'm alone.
Rule number 6, pursue continuous growth with Robin Sharma.
I believe you're happiest not when you're watching TV. You're not happiest when you're playing with your apps. You're not happiest when you're looking for likes. You're not happiest when you're fooling around. You're happiest when you're growing. I think we're hardwired, that it's a survival mechanism. We're happiest when we're making progress. So we have a deep fear of self-betrayal. And when we don't capitalize on our talents, what starts to happen is that we start to lose energy, we lose creativity, and we lose productivity. I believe that many of us, the reason we don't have energy, the reason why we're not as creative as we want, the reason why we're not as productive as we want, is because we have betrayed our talent, and the deep, wise, primal hero within knows of that self-betrayal, and we start to hate ourselves. Is that an interesting point, show of hands? The place of knowing within you knows that you've betrayed your talents, and we start to hate ourselves. And so we have a deep well of self-loathing inside of us that actually minimizes the four interior empires, and the four interior empires are the gateway into the exterior empires of creativity, productivity, performance, prosperity, lifestyle, and impact. How do you get to creativity, productivity, prosperity, performance, lifestyle, and impact? Through the four interior empires. Mindset, heart set, health set, and soul set. So that first fear is important. Second fear, fear of standing out. Well, how are you going to innovate if you haven't worked through your fear? This is why personal mastery is the gateway into, it's the gateway drug into world class.
And rule number 7, the last one before some very special bonus clips, is don't work for the money with Robert Kiyosaki.
The irony of it, you know, when I left school in the 60s, there were plenty of jobs, but the world has changed.
Yeah.
And our schools haven't. And so they're still making this innate promise of get a job. And I was very fortunate when I graduated in 69. We're the highest paid graduates in the world. My classmates were making about $120,000 to $150,000 a year. Wow. That's not much money today, mm-hmm. but 1969, that was a lot of money. But naturally, as young guys do, we spent every penny of it. So I had my rich dad's lesson, the rich don't work for money, in my head. I said, okay, I'm making all this money. I have a secure job, but what's beyond that? And that's where education comes in. So if I could explain this to you for the rest of the millennial lessons, it's really going to be on this theme here. Because financial education is about not working for money. Mm-hmm. like one of the first questions when I finally realized what my rich dad was saying, I said, well, when do I never need a paycheck again? See, my goal wasn't, you know, go to the moon or, you know, cure cancer. My job was, when would I never need a paycheck again? Because as long as you need a paycheck, be it from an employer or like my poor dad, he was so afraid of losing his government pension.
Yeah.
And I'm going, Jesus, what a way to run your life, your pension?
Mm-hmm.
So my old man kind of got fired. He lost his pension. It was the most frightening thing in the world to him. He had no pension. Then it was Social Security, which is even worse.
Yeah.
So that's why my goal when I was about your age, a little older, around 25, I said, my goal is to never need a paycheck again from anybody, even the government. I don't want any Medicare, Social Security, or whatever. That, you know, while I was a military pilot, I said, oh, you got to get the military pilot pension. I said, you do, but I'm not going to. And just because of this here, that was the difference. Because I never wanted to work for money to need a paycheck. So the next few lessons in Millennial Money, you'll find out what I do work for. So for right now, just let me go to the lesson here. So this comes from Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and these are some of the distinctions. It was the advantage I had at age 9, because I knew what I wanted to work for. And this here, in simple terms, is called a financial statement. In school, they teach you get a FICO score.
Mm-hmm.
FICO is BS. All that means, how good are you paying your bills? That's all FICO means, okay? Should be the FIDO score. Good dog. So this is what your banker wants to see. So when I was 9 years old, playing Monopoly with my rich dad, this is the lesson that's not included in Monopoly, but Rich Dad taught me. And fundamentally, the problem that most people make, they go to school to get a job and they work here. So this is the poor middle class and these guys. And we're going to talk about later, your first line item expense is taxes. You know, just recently, President Trump said he had a tax cut. He didn't have a tax cut for these guys. As you know, the rules are always written for the rich, okay? I didn't make the rules. You can get angry at me, but these are the rules. The rich make the rules,
yeah.
The golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules.
Yeah.
So the tax cut went to people here.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it goes to. You'll learn more about this later on. But this is what I work for. So what I work for, number one, is I'm an entrepreneur. I want businesses. I have multiple businesses. And I don't work in them, as you know, because you work here. You never see me, do you?
No.
Because I don't work for a paycheck.
Exactly.
Next is real estate, and real estate is good for many things which we'll go into, but number one is debt. I use a lot of debt to buy real estate, and I pay no taxes. That's the relationship there. The next is paper, and that's savings, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs, and that stuff. I don't have any of that stuff. I don't save money. I don't have any of that. But this is what most people have, go to school, get a job, get a 401k, and save money. Loser. Okay. I'm doing that just to upset you guys, because maybe you'll start to think. Because I didn't make the rules, I'm just telling you these are the rules. These people pay the highest taxes, and they work the hardest. And the last are commodities, four different asset classes. So commodities are, number one is gold, silver, oil, land, water, food. So this is what I work for. When I left school, rather than working for a paycheck and working for money, my education had to go beyond getting a job, which I had a good job. But I now had to start, when I left school, about your age, the thing I focused on first actually was commodities. So back in 1972, I started buying gold. And it was illegal for Americans to own gold. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
Back in 72. Today you have Bitcoin. It's different, okay? Everything is changing so rapidly today. So I started with gold, but actually the next thing was actually oil. because I went to school to be a tanker officer driving ships for Standard Oil. So I understand oil. So I own, my wife and I don't own Standard Oil or Chevron or Exxon. We own oil wells. Again, taxes. You get no tax breaks for owning paper oil, huge tax breaks for owning real oil.
Yeah.
And then I went into real estate. Why? Because I can use debt to buy real estate. And because I use debt, I pay no taxes. Mm-hmm. And then third, I started my business, my first real business. I had many, many businesses as a kid. But my first real business was a nylon and Velcro surfer wallet business. And I went worldwide right away. The trouble is I was an idiot and the business went up and the business came down. What kept me alive was this and this. Okay. So you may say, well, aren't you working for money? But we'll go into that next. I don't want what's called a paycheck. Mm-hmm. I want cash flow. From here. So that's what I mean by the rich don't work for money. You want cash flow that pays very little taxes, and I can use lots of debt over here. The average person who went to school, their biggest liability they have is student loans, of course.
Yeah, of course, definitely.
I mean, it's horrible what they do to you guys today. You have student loans, which is the worst type of debt of all because you cannot declare bankruptcy on it. Then you get out, you try and buy a house, and you call it an asset when it's really a liability. Why? Because the cash is flowing that way. Your house costs you money. You rent a house, it still costs you money. Okay. Then you have to have a nice car. I had one of those. Yes. So the problem with most young people is they go to school to get that job, then a lot of them have student loan debt. Then they try and get married and buy a house, have a car, and then they have credit card debt. But they never have the chance to come over here. If they do any investing in America, it's a 401k, which I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. Now, you should, but I don't, because I don't have to. Because I went to school for here, and people who don't go to school should be here. This is a 401k, IRA, ETFs, and that stuff, paper. Savings. I don't touch that stuff. And we'll go into that later on.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I say rich don't work for money, I never wanted to be dependent on a paycheck, either from an employer or the government. I wanted to be a free human being.
Practice gives you ultimate freedom. The more you practice, the better you get at something, the more skilled you are at it, the more information you have, the more it actually allows you to play more, have more fun, be more flexible, and have ultimately more freedom. This is something I struggled with a lot in the early days of my speaking career. I was asked to speak at a bunch of events, and this is what, 20 years ago, I guess, I've had as a speaking career now. And I used to be so worried about disappointing people that I would memorize my entire speech. I would practice and practice and practice and practice and practice and just memorize my speech to the point where word for word, it would be the exact same thing every time. And I thought that was good. I thought that's what you're supposed to do. Obviously, yes, practice makes perfect. Keep going, keep practicing, keep doing it. And what ended up happening was, yes, I delivered the same speech each time, but I think the worst thing you can do as a speaker is just give the exact same speech every time. We did a session of movement makers around the signature talk. It was one of the most voted topics was how do I give my signature talk? And I think having one signature talk is actually not great. I think you should be able to speak to the audience every time. Your job, if you're a speaker, is to give your audience a fantastic experience. And so it's knowing who's in the audience. Don't assume it's the same people every single time, right? So you have to be able to know so much about your subject that then you can have your framework that you operate in, but then give a lot more value to people by making it custom to them. So now whenever I'm doing a speaking gig, I'm always asking, okay, tell me about the audience. Tell me who's here. Tell me why people are setting it up. What are people here for? Both in terms of the information they're hoping to get, as well as their background and their interests and their concerns and what they struggle with. And of course, there's genuine human struggles that everybody goes through, but why are people here at this conference? And so here's my process right now when I'm doing a speech or a talk. They're going to have me come in. They're going to talk about Believe or entrepreneurship or YouTube. There's going to be some set themes. You're not having me come to talk about my apple strudel recipe because I don't have one, right? I'm coming in to talk about things that are inside my domain. Perfect. And I could easily just get up on stage and talk, but I want to know who's in the audience. So before going, I'll ask them, tell me about the people who are going to be here. And then I'll frame my speech around a couple of key ideas that I think would be valuable to that audience, still sitting within kind of my usual domain. Perfect. I'll practice it. I'll practice giving a speech. I'll practice the points. At home, I'll practice. I'll practice talking to my dog. I'll practice on the airplane on the way over. I'll practice to kind of get a sense of the stories that I want to tell that I think will be the right fit. But then the day before and the day of, I like to be there a little early to talk to people. One makes me feel a little more comfortable being able to connect to people in the audience. So it's not just people I don't know, but I've had a few conversations with people. But two, in feeling the vibe out of the event, I'll often end up switching up part of my talk. Again, to make it as customizable as possible to the people that I'm talking to. And this isn't just a speaking thing, guys. This is any interaction you're doing. You're trying to sell your product, trying to sell your service. You're on a call with somebody who could use your product or service, hire you as a coach, etc. You have to customize your pitch, customize your talk for them. Not just give the same thing every single time you're talking to somebody. You have to know what makes them tick, know why they're talking to you, what their deep desires and fears are, and address those things so that you can close the sale, right? It's the same thing. I'm just giving an example through speaking. So it's being willing to deviate from your talk to actually give more value. And I think, again, the worst thing you can do as a speaker is just get on stage and give the same talk every single time. That's what I used to think was the way to go, but this is actually a lot more valuable because you can inspire people, but one, it becomes boring for you to get up and just do the same thing over and over and over again. And two, if you can customize it to actually address the thing that they're specifically concerned about, you're going to have a bigger impact. Why are you there? You're there to touch people. You're there to move people to a positive direction, right? Again, whether you're speaking or you're just talking to somebody on the phone, a potential client, why are you working with them? Yes, they're going to pay you, but why? You want them to get a result. You want them to move. You want them to make a change. You want to solve a problem for them. And so the more you can actually connect to what they're struggling with, the easier it is for you to close the sale and have the impact that you're trying to have. So it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more impactful, a lot more meaningful. And so that's my usual process now. Why are people here? I'll prepare a version of my speech to address those people. And then it always changes up the day of because I met somebody in the lobby who inspired me, or I met somebody on the airplane the day before who shifted my thinking a little bit and gives me an extra story to tell. And when you're so prepared and you know your stuff so much, it's easy to add those things in. When you don't really know, you're kind of all over the place. So it's being overly prepared and then the day of being willing to be flexible. It's that like rigidity of practice and practice and practice and knowing what you're doing so much that allows you to play when you show up. It's the, if you, you know, go into sports, you practice your free throws so much, you practice your penalty shots so much, you practice so much that allows you to be a lot more flexible and play when it comes to game time. Let me share another quick example from the opposite side where I was interviewing somebody. So instead of being the person on stage speaking, I'm interviewing somebody. And I recently had Tony Robbins on the channel. And it was the third time he came on the channel. The first two interviews we did had 3 million views on them combined, which is amazing. And he's coming back for the third time, talk about his new book. And I'm always nervous before a big interview. And this is probably the least nervous I've been because it's the third time on, but I was still nervous going in. And so I'm preparing. I'm preparing. I'm trying to find a thread that I care about. I don't want to just ask the same questions everybody else has asked. I don't want to just use the questions that his PR agency sent over because he's going to answer those questions on every other show. I want it to be different and unique and fun and special. And so I prepared. I know I've got half an hour with him. I know he likes to go long in his stories, so you don't get that many questions in. So I need to really be careful of what I'm going to say and make this time count. It'd be easy just to show up and ask, okay, why did you write this book? What does it mean to you? What do you hope people get from it? What was your favorite part about it? And then half an hour is done and you haven't really asked anything super meaningful. So I'm preparing. And I wrote down on a notepad file that I had open when I was talking to him, you know, five questions that I wanted to ask. And I practiced how I would ask them. I practiced, you know, what I was going to say. And then I practiced it so much that come showtime, here we go, Tony's coming on. Let's do our one-on-one. I was able to actually be present and listen to what it was saying and play ball with him, right? To throw and catch with him instead of just going to the questions. When you haven't prepared and you're really insecure, you just go to the questions. You just go, okay, here's what I said. Okay, here, and just ask the questions. Where the best interviews are when you can throw and catch, right? Where they say something and you take that a little bit deeper as opposed to just moving on to the next question. Because I've watched a lot of interviews in the work that I do. And one of the things that I find most frustrating is the person says something amazing and you want them to, it's like, okay, ask a follow-up question. And instead of asking a follow-up question, they just go to the next question. Because the interviewer, it was never even listening to what the interviewee was saying. They're just so worried about getting the next question in that that's all they're thinking about. And so like, okay, great. And then tell me about this next question without going deeper into the conversation. So I didn't want to be that kind of interviewer. Even I get it, because you're nervous. You're not fully prepared. You're worried about the questions. So one example with Tony, he was talking about a recent health scare that he had and that his career would be over. The doctor said, your career is over. And in my head, I was thinking about some of the other stuff I knew about Tony Robbins. And so I asked him,
how many times have you been told that your career is over?
It was off script, right? It wasn't something his team prepared. It wasn't something Tony's maybe been asked. And I asked him, how many times have you been told that your career has been over? Because I remember, he had this tumor that made him grow crazy quickly. And people said his life would be over. I remember he burned out his voice box and his doctors told him he'd never speak on stage again. And now this injury that happened to him, he wasn't gonna be able to go and do his events. So he's been told consistently that his career would be over. And yet he still gets up and he finds a way and he does it, right? And one of the things that we love about his ability to follow through and stay consistent. And so in the over preparation and knowing his story and also knowing that I had questions to fall back on in case there was a lull in the conversation, it allows the play. It allows the freedom. It allows you to adjust to the situation, which then creates a much better experience. So whether you're speaking, whether you're interviewing, whether you're coaching, whether you're mentoring, whether you're on a sales call, you need to know your script. You need to know what you're going to say. You need to understand your customer and who you're talking to. You need to know all that and over-prepare. But then understand that the greatest asset that you have is not in rehearsing again the script, it's that you have the ability to be free now, that you can play because you've done all the drills and now you need to have the back and forth. It's throwing and catching. I'm going to throw the ball to you, you're going to catch it, you're going to throw the ball back to me. It's not just throwing, where a lot of times the biggest mistake is that you're just throwing. You're just throwing another one and another one. And here's my other line. Here's my next question. Here's my next pitch. Throw. And the person might be saying, but there's no receiving and them throwing the ball back to you. That's the best part in any interaction. If you have a goal to get them to move forward, to make a change in their life, to sign you up, to hire you, to work with you, so that you can make that impact that you're trying to make, there has to be that back and forth. And the more prepared you are, the easier it is to then have the freedom to play.
Just being honest, even when it sucks, because let me tell you how many times it's gonna be where if you just lied, oh God, it would be so much easier and you would probably get away with it. The way that I explain lying to people is you get away with it 50% of the time. And so it tempts you to think it's a good strategy. Mm. But the other 50% of the time, it is cratering trust. And once you can't trust the person, all hope is lost. And there's nothing more beautiful than being in a relationship with somebody who makes you feel like they're number one and that you totally trust them. And Lisa wrote this Instagram post about how she could see a photo of me with my arm around a woman or resting my head on a woman or hugging her or whatever. And she, it wouldn't even make her radar to question it. So that's the fun for us, is having that level of trust. Now, it's like, I think it's Buffett that said, you spend your entire life building your reputation, only takes 5 seconds to lose it. So it's like, we're so careful. We, for 18 years, we've been earning trust with each other. So like, dude, so especially when I was back at Quest, and it was, women would come and flirt and hit on me because they wanted something, wanted to be sponsored by the company or whatever. And I was around bikini, literal bikini models, like all the time. And so if ever there was going to be a moment of insecurity for my wife, it would have been that period. A, she wasn't insecure. And B, the thought of throwing away 18 years of shared experience of all that trust and everything, it's, sex is like rad and super exciting and I love it the most, but like compared to what I would have to give up for something like that, it just doesn't rate on the radar. So, and by the way, something like I'm saying now, which most people would hide from their spouse. Oh, that, yeah, of course I find other people attractive. What are you talking about? Like, we just openly talk about that. Like, she'll nudge me and be like, oh my God, don't you think she's hot? It's like, that's just, we set up early on in the relationship to be aggressively ourselves. And one thing that we both were really honest about was, I was like, look, it is human nature. You are going to find other guys attractive. And I will actually trust you more if you admit when you find somebody attractive than if you say something stupid like, I only have eyes for you. Oh, really? You're the only human in all of history to like, you know, transcend their human nature. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that's a super fragile place to be, because what happens if I get older? What happens if I get injured or scarred? Like, then I'm really supposed to believe that suddenly you're more attracted to somebody with a scar than somebody without? Like, it doesn't make sense. So we all live in this fragile bubble of, well, as long as they lie to me, it's okay. And as long as I'm willing to believe, and even though secretly I know it's a lie, and then it's the more pious than thou, like, oh my God, she's thinking all these nice things about me, but I'm actually finding other people attractive and I'm just lying about it. And so then you're like, wait, if I'm lying about it, is she lying about it? And so it just, it erodes all that trust. So from the jump, we were like, look, you're going to find other people attractive. I'm going to find other people attractive. But let me introduce you to this magical word called commitment. Now, I'm with you because I love you, because I respect you. But I'm also with you because I'm committed to you. And so you don't have to worry that I'm going to be looking over my shoulder for a more attractive woman. There are going to be more attractive women than you, for sure, especially as you age. Who the fuck cares? Mm. You're my wife. We have shared an experience. We've shared a life. We've built this around each other. And commitment means something to me, going back to having that code that you live by. And the rules and the code that I live by, I'm never going to betray that.
Yeah.
So it's like, we've always said, I may break up with you one day, because I'm not saying that like, oh, there's nothing you could do that would make me break up with you. For sure there is. But I'm never going to cheat on you. I may come and say, I'm breaking up with you because I'm going to go have sex with somebody else, but I'm absolutely not going to go have sex with somebody behind your back. Never going to happen. Mm. So like having that trust and knowing who the other person is, like all that stuff is super meaningful. And look, there's just more and more and more stuff, but those are some big ones.
I'll ask you a very simple question. Why does your organization exist? We don't need you. Clearly there's plenty of competition. Clearly people have plenty of choices. Even the things that you may specialize in, there are others that do a reasonably good job. They might even be better than you in some areas. So why do you exist? Providing education is table stakes. Everybody here does that. You can't rely on that. That's why the industry exists, not why your organization exists. That's like when I talk to healthcare companies and say, why does your organization exist? And they say, to help people be more healthy. Like, no kidding, thank you. But I know that the culture of one organization is different than the culture of another organization. There are cultural norms that wrap around the sense of purpose, cause, or belief. Great organizations understand their just cause, a cause so just that people would be willing to sacrifice to see the advancement of that cause. Sacrifice comes in many forms. It might mean working longer hours, giving you my best ideas, turning down a better job that offers me more money to stay here because I believe in what you're doing and I want to see that advanced. One of my favorite examples of a just cause is the Declaration of Independence. Our founding fathers declared, literally wrote down, they declared why we needed our own country. All men are created equal, endowed with these unalienable rights, amongst which include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They were never against Britain. The whole point is not to be against something, but to stand for something. Britain was simply standing in the way of them advancing their cause. And though they won independence, there are always finite games within the infinite game, though they won independence, that didn't mean that they had now provided all men are equal. Now the real heavy lifting began. Now let's be crystal clear. When they said all men are equal, what they meant was white Protestant men. Let's be crystal clear. But even early on, during the Revolutionary War, George Washington understood how limiting that was, and he realized that they had to have a broader definition. So he included Catholics. He banned any organizing against Catholics in his armies, and he would regularly attend Mass to send the right message. Sometime later, we abolished slavery and the 14th Amendment. Sometime later, we had women's suffrage. Sometime later, we had Civil Rights Act. Sometime later, we implement gay rights. And you can see that we are striving to provide this thing called all men are equal, all people are equal. And though we'll never actually get there, we will die trying. And the obstacles may always be different. And what a just cause is, it is a vision of the future that does not yet exist, and you will commit all of your energies to advance that vision of the world that you have. And the people you want to attract, both those who work there, those who teach there, and both those who come to learn there, believe in your vision of the future. So much so that they may turn down a better offer from someone else because they want to be around people who are committed to building this world that does not yet exist. And every single one of these organizations that you run and represent can have different visions or overlapping visions of the world. But you must be clear what your just cause is, what you stand for. Otherwise, the only thing I have to judge you on is superficial things. It's like dating, right? It's like dating. If somebody tells me what they stand for, who they are, they're talking about their character. And those are the people we want to spend the rest of our lives with. If we do not have any sense of who they are, what they stand for, what their purpose, what their cause, what their beliefs are, what their values are, the only thing we have to judge them on is how much money they make and how good looking they are.
You're here today and you'd love a sporty car, but well, let me guess, you want something that's a little good on the gas, maybe eco-friendly so you can do your part. I got this amazing two-seater, it's fast, it's eco-friendly, it's this, it's that. Let's go take a look at it. Now that's a sales guy that could make a job for 27 years and he wants you to understand him. But what if you went there that day because you just had your third child and you want your wife to have something that's not a minivan, but the big SUVs are too clunky, and you're just looking for something in the middle, nothing even close. Now that same salesperson that wanted you to understand him, what if there's a salesperson that comes out, and you see him walking over to you, and you're like, oh shit, here comes a sales guy. You roll down your window, or you get out, and he says, hey, listen, first off, I know it's a Saturday, we all work on commissions. Authenticity, transparency. We all work on commissions. It's my turn up. I get you. But I just want to tell you, let me just back up. I just want to ask, why are you here today? What's your family like? How can I serve you? Tell me a little bit about you. And all of a sudden the person says, wow. Immediately, who do you have rapport with immediately? Sales guy number two. Because he wants you to feel understood, and probably not on purpose, that's just who he is. All of a sudden you go, well, we had our third kid, and you go, oh my God, I'm on my fourth, I get it. My wife hated the minivan. When I thought about bringing it to her house, she was like, are you crazy? But then I looked at the Monster Escalade, and she's, that's a bus. But we figured out something in between. Would you be open to something kind of in the middle? It's kind of like the sporty, smaller SUV. All of a sudden you're laughing, high-fiving, talking about the names of your kids, what's going on in school, they're playing softball or baseball and what they do, and all of a sudden you're sitting in a car going, it's a good guy. And what did he do most of the time? He listened. He was authentic.
One of my greatest lessons that I learned in starting and running Twitter and starting and running Square, which is how important it is to instrument all usage. You have to instrument everything. For the first 2 years of Twitter's life, we were flying blind. We had no idea what was going on with the network. We had no idea what was going on with the system, with how people were using it. We're making guesses. We're basing everything on intuition instead of having a good balance between intuition and data. And we were going down all the time because of it, because we could not see what was happening. So the first thing I wrote for Square on the server was an admin dashboard. And we have a very, very strong discipline within the company, which is now 72 people, to log everything, to measure everything, and to test everything. And we treat the dashboard, we treat the analytics, we treat the data as a product. And we call it the inference team. And their job is to instrument all usage and infer all action. And that's something that we need, but it's also something that our users need.
What does max out really stand for you? And when did that moment happen where you knew that that was gonna be part of your brand?
Yeah, my son's name's Max, so that helped. But maxed out to me means this, as you know, your obsessions become your possessions. Whatever you end up being obsessed with, you'll eventually possess. So if you're obsessed with what you're worried about, your fears, your problems, you're going to possess those. And so I became obsessed. The short version is that, and you don't know this, I don't talk about this on camera very much. When I was 30, my uncle died at 50 years old. And he was the guy in my family, we all have this, that you kind of resemble or remind everybody of.
Oh, right.
My dad's brother. He died at 50.
Sorry.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. It's a long time ago now. Yeah. And but he was kind of was my godfather, and in my culture, that's a big deal.
Of course, mine as well.
Yeah, I know.
And, shout out Uncle Mike.
Yeah, mine was Uncle Mike.
Whoa.
Whoa, 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 whoa. He's got chills everywhere right there. Whoa, 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 whoa. 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 Man.
That's how the universe works, right?
Ooh. Wow, okay. You got me right there. So mine was my Uncle Mike. Wow. And...
oh man, that just touched me.
So, mine was my Uncle Mike. And that blows my mind right there, brother. So, I'm at his funeral. We're flying back on the flight. There's this thing in your brain called the reticular activating system. It basically filters into your awareness what's important to you. That's why, like, if you buy a new car, all of a sudden you see that car everywhere on the freeway, three lanes over on the other side, boom, another one. They were always there. Why do you see them now? It's filtered into your importance. And heart attacks were at my, he had died of a heart attack. And so I'm on the airplane and I'm listening to music, and on the screen's the Oprah show, but it's in my awareness and it's a heart on the screen. I'm like, unplug my headphones, plug it into the phone system. And it was about a new heart scan that was happening at Cedars-Sinai where they could, like, it's common now, but they could non-invasively look at your heart and your arteries. Long story short, I hear it and I told my wife, I said, schedule me for one of those exams. Right. She's like, it's expensive. I said, I don't care, schedule it. We call, it's a 9-month wait. I go, I need to get in. I keep calling the lady. Finally, she goes, there's a cancellation tomorrow at 2. I go, I'll be there. So I go down for the scan. And thank God this doctor understood influence and leverage. You do the scan, then you come back after lunch. I literally went, ate a burrito, came back. I wasn't in shape. I'm 30 years old. The doctor comes out and he goes, I'm looking for Edward Milet. I go, it's Milet, you know, and he goes, he knew. And he goes, whoa, I can't believe these arteries are in that young a body.
Wow.
You need to come back, son. Now my heart's racing. I'm like, what the hell's in this scan? We sit down. Instead of what a normal doctor would do, they just go, hey, here's the prescription. Take Crestor, work out, eat good, bye. He understood reasons is what changes people's lives. Massive reasons, not discipline, reasons and habits, right? He goes, let me ask you a question. Your wife's beautiful. Do you have kids? I go, yeah. I go, I got a son. He's 1. He goes, that's great. Do you want to be there when he graduates high school? I went, what? He goes, do you want to be there when he graduates high school? I said, yeah. He goes, okay, is she pregnant, huh? I go, yeah, what is she having? I said, a girl. You get to a dad, this is what you say. He goes, would you like to walk that little girl down the aisle on her wedding day, son? I went, what? What is in this scan, dude? And he goes, I want to be very clear with you, young man. I remember this like yesterday. He goes, I want to be very clear with you, young man. If you continue down the road you're going, another man's going to live with your beautiful wife in your mansion, walk your son at graduation, and he's gonna be arm in arm with your daughter on her wedding day, not you. You'll be long gone. Actually, as I tell you this right now, dude, right? Wow. And he goes, what I'm gonna get you to do is I'm gonna get you to max out your life and your fitness. And I went, give me it.
Yeah.
And he gave me exactly what I needed to do. And he said, if you do this, you'll walk her down the aisle, blah, blah, blah. From that day, when I get up like I did this morning and I'm tired and I was late last night and I don't want to go to the gym, I swear to you, brother, I swear to you, I go, Bella's wedding, get your ass up. and I go. I'm fit because I have massive reasons. That's why I'm fit. And that started the journey towards maxing out every area of my life. I'm like, if I can do this in my fitness, I can do this in business, I can do this in my spirituality and everything. I'm not gonna shortchange myself by pretty good. I'm gonna see what my real potential is, what my maximum capacity is every single day. Because at the end of my life, when I do die, I have this belief that when I'm done, the Lord's gonna go, well done, good and faithful servant. And by the way, here's the man you could have been. This is the man you were born to be. This is the man you were destined to be. This is where you could have gone, what you could have seen, the memories you could have had, the people you could have helped, the person you could have become. Right. Meet him. My obsession is that every day I'm chasing that dude so that when I do die, we meet, we're identical twins. Because the bad end of a life, whether it would be at 30, 50, or 150, would be I meet that guy and we're total strangers.
Yeah.
So I'm obsessed with meeting that guy someday. Yeah. And that's what maxing out means.
In that year when I was really broken, I was working at LA Unified School District. I was miserable. I was miserable because I wasn't living in my dream. I was just doing a J-O-B. And then one day I said, well, what do I need to do? I need to buy my freedom. That's what I need to do. I need to buy my freedom. Well, I don't know about buying my freedom. I don't know about having money saved up. My family didn't have money saved up. My mother used to tell me, oh, this money is burning my pocket. So I know two things about money. It's hot and we can't keep it long. We'd always have 1 week where we had all the food in the refrigerator and then 1 week where the refrigerator was empty. Yes. Right? Come on. Some of you guys know about that. To this day, I spend so much money on groceries. You guys, oh my God, it's like I'm feeding like a family of 10 because I'm so afraid of anybody ever being in my house and being hungry. Right? And so I wrote a check to myself. Jelani was three, $110. I took it to the bank, Wells Fargo. I started a new account. The next check I wrote, $125. And just like the first check, I put in the memo line, funding my dream. I wasn't even clear what the dream was. But I knew there was something in my belly. Who in this room know you got something in your belly? It's something. I'm not even clear about it. I don't know how clear you are, but I wasn't clear about it. But I knew there was a calling on my life greater than working for LA Unified School District. And no disrespect to LA Unified School District. It just wasn't my destiny.
In today's world, we are so busy with social media and our phones sitting next to us and Facebook and Instagram and emails and text messages that we're running faster than we ever have in our entire life. So when you're so busy, it's like we have a cloud around us. And setting goals just doesn't work for most people in today's crazy fast-paced world. When's the last time you tried to sit down and look forward to where you're gonna be in a year or 5 years? It's hard, right? It doesn't work anymore. So I wanna give you a little hack. Don't set goals. Create a vision for yourself, and here's how you do it. Let's pretend it's a year from now, and you're looking back on your year, and it was the best financial year of your entire life. You're making the money you want, you have the confidence you want, you have the courage you want, you're living in the house you want, you have the job you want, you're treating your husband, your wife, your children, your parents the way you want. You're walking around looking younger, feeling better. What does that look like to you? Write that down as fast as you can. Write down a vision for yourself. Instead of looking forward, you're pretending it's a year from now, you're looking back, best year of your life. Write it down. That's your vision. That becomes the new way to goals. Again, goals is looking forward, vision is looking backwards.
The one you need to live with, wake up to every day is that right there. Okay? Beat the sun up, folks. You gotta beat the sun up. If you can't beat up the roll up of the sun up, you're gonna get beat up in life, okay? I've been doing this for a long time now. I say beat that thing up, that monster out there that warms this planet, that nourishes and gives us light, the 10X life. But you can't live a 10X life if you're not beating the sun up. So many of you complain about how much time you have. You don't have time, man, because you don't beat the sun up. Get started early. And when you get started early, that means you need to shut it down early, okay? Shut it down early so you get sleep. I was asleep last night at 9 o'clock. So I could beat the sun up this morning and see the world wake up with me.
If you're not doing block time, here's what your day might look like. You have all these different slots of time, right? And you're just gonna plug in as you go through the day. You're gonna plug in, oh, I'll work some there, and I'll work some there, and then I'll try to cram stuff up. Right at the end of the day, I'll try to cram that sucker in. Any crammers? 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 Okay, just checking. No judgment, no judgment. You're just not going as fast as you could. That's all. Crammers, I love crammers. Yeah, just like, because they're easy to get to move faster, because you do have that diligence of when there's a deadline and it's on, you can go, which really serves you. But we gotta take you from a crammer to a preparer to a high performer. And the way that we do that is to look at this and go, listen, if you keep leaving all these time slots to randomness, what happens is they start to get filled with the big D. Distraction. Some reason it seems like this hit home for some people. I don't know why. How many recognize what I'm talking about here? So now you add up, take this out. You might not be thinking too seriously about it, but let's say that's like a day. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 work hours. You didn't know I drew that on purpose. If you leave your time to randomness, you are stealing from your greatness. If you leave your time to randomness, you are stealing from your greatness bit by bit, hour by hour, day by day, week by week, month by month, quarter by quarter, year by year, and decade by decade. And it's the little things like this where you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't get anything done, because you've got all these random approaches to your day. And so for those who are like, but Brendan, I'm a free spirit. I'm like, oh God, I love free spirits. Me too. Let's go on a yoga retreat. I don't have any time. Oh, free spirit, no time for yoga retreat? Aww. You know why free spirit ain't got no time for a yoga retreat? Because they ain't got no discipline. If they had some discipline, free spirit would have time for some yoga retreat. So if you want more free time, you need more discipline time. It's so simple.
One of the lines from right out of the 5 a.m. Club is, one of the DNAs of legendary is longevity. So if you look at the Picassos, the Jean-Michel Basquiat, you look at the great sports champions, you look at the great history makers, they were much better at energy management than time management. And so we're in a war against distraction right now, and what we really have to do is optimize our energy. How do I do it? Well, I mean, I get to the morning routine, which the whole book is based on. But it's really quite powerful, because if you start your day with sweaty exercise, you're actually going to activate a pharmacy of mastery that exists in every human brain. I know you love the neuroscience. You're going to release BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. That's going to actually accelerate your processing. It's actually going to repair brain cells that have been damaged by stress. You're going to release the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is the fire neurotransmitter, which we all need as entrepreneurs and business builders and servants of humanity. Cortisol, the fear hormone, is highest in the morning. So exercising first thing in the morning is going to reduce that. I'm getting into my 20-20-20 formula, but I mention it because it is a way to maximize your energy.
So talk to us about the 20-20-20. I mean, you sort of started it there with the sweaty exercise, but what's the rest of that formula, which is pretty powerful?
Sure. So the new book is all about rising at 5 a.m., and that's because if you look at the great creatives and the great saints and the great humanitarians and the great titans of industry, many of them got up at 5 a.m. Even right now, you've got Tim Cook and you've got Howard Schultz, and it goes on and on. Before the sun rises is the time of least distraction. Before the sun rises, where you can build intimacy and fluency with what you want to stand for in your day. Before the sun rises, the luxury and tranquility of the early morning hours, you can do that deep inner work that will allow you to go out in the world and play at your best. So what the 20-20-20 formula is simply this. There's three pockets. The first pocket is move, 5 to 5:20. And you get into the sweaty exercise because, like I mentioned, it releases neurotransmitters, it reduces the cortisol, increases your metabolic rate, which gives you more energy. So now, and serotonin as well, which gives you joy.
So now it's 5:20. Fundamentally, you feel different. You have energy. Your state is strong. You've got a fire in your belly, and you've accelerated your focus. 5:20 to 5:40 is the second pocket of the 20-20-20 formula, which is reflect. We live in a world where a lot of people are busy being busy, but what's the point of being busy around climbing the wrong Mount Everests? And so clarity is one of the DNAs of mastery. You know this. If you talk to the titans of industry and you talk to the people really getting traction around their ambition, these are people who have a monomaniacal focus on the few things that matter. They have an obsession bordering on a possession around the few priorities they want to build their life around. And so 5:20 to 5:40, the second pocket, you write in a journal. You meditate. You visualize. You do what I call in the book a blueprint for a beautiful day. Or you just sit in solitude and you think and you ponder and you reflect. And then the final pocket is 5:40 to 6 o'clock, and this is the victory hour. The final pocket is grow. But if you look at the greatest billionaires, I've coached many billionaires over the past 20 years. If you look at the greatest producers on the planet, these people have one thing in common. They are ridiculously curious. And no matter how much money they make and no matter how much impact they have, they maintain a white belt mentality. One of the keys to epic performance is a relentless commitment to daily growth. So that's the 20-20-20 formula that the 5 a.m. method is built around. And the premise is basically this: as you begin your day, so you handcraft the rest of your day. And if you have consistently great days, you're going to have consistently great weeks, quarters, year, and a lifetime. So your days are your life in miniature, and you got to get those mornings calibrated if you really want to win.
No matter how far you get in life, you have to be able to go back to scratch in your mind at a moment's notice. You can never get so far beyond scratch. Mm. What that means is, when you accomplish something in life, if you want to go back to scratch and go back to that $7 a month place where I once lived and visit that place for a long period of time, if you were here when you went back to scratch, you would now be here. Mm. Scratch is what makes you better. Scratch, friction, obstacles create growth. There's no friction when you're this far up in the game anymore. You think there
right,
is.
When you've achieved,
that's
yeah.
right. When you achieve so much, the friction is minor. Because why? I'm sore. I'm going to get a massage today. Mm-hmm. I'm hungry. I'm going to eat today. Mm-hmm. The refrigerator is always full. So your comforts are now, so your discomfort is now very minuscule to your discomfort back here in the $7 a month place. So you have to go back to the total discomfort to then raise your level of where you're at now. Mm. I'm not saying stay there and stay there. Visit
it.
And then you raise your level.
Take a day trip.
That's right.
Yeah.
Always take day trips.
Yeah. Don't stay there.
That's right.
But take a day trip.
Take a day trip.
So when you complete some massive obstacle and challenge, mm-hmm. whatever the adversity that you force upon yourself, because mm-hmm. these are all curated experiences for yourself
right.
that you're scratching constantly. What happens now, since this was 5 years ago, you would just leave, you wouldn't take the medal, you would just go on to the next. What happens now? Do you take, you know, a day to reflect, a moment, 10 minutes, like how does the process work? And then how do you get back to visiting the $7, you know, place you lived in?
Now, I don't have to go back and visit it. I don't have to think about it. It lives with me now. Mm. Every day of my damn life, that feeling that I had to go back and think about, I found a way to just have it.
How did you?
It's constantly there. Mm. I have a self-talk, it's called my cookie jar. Mm-hmm. And it's a constant reminder of David God. Every day of my life, I believe in quiet. There's no growth outside of quiet. The world's too noisy. Your mind needs quiet for you to find who you are. People ask, what's my purpose? Why am I here? You're not going to find it nowadays unless you lock yourself in a quiet room in your mind and find it. It's too noisy. For me, I could be in a busy street in New York City, horns honking, and I'm walking around with like nothing. It's me and myself
yeah.
in a quiet spot. And when you are constantly reflecting on who you are, where you've been,
the journey you've gone through, the journey you can continue going through, the feeling's always there. You don't allow the world to pull you so fast that you forget. You don't allow yourself to pull you so fast that you forget. It's not about staying in that moment. It's about you want to get to the point where that feeling follows you like breathing.
Mm.
It becomes a part of your life, part of your DNA. But it's made. Like these calluses on my hands right now, they're made.
Yeah.
They are now on my brain. This is now a part of me. It's a daily process, a part of me. And how I go back to that $7 a month place all the time is now I go out and I dig fire line. I'm a wildland firefighter. I don't need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a 43-year-old man. I work with 27-year-old kids.
Yeah.
And I'm a rookie. Every day I'm a rookie, it feels like.
There is one habit that I have adopted in the last 3 years that has fundamentally changed me as a business person. And it has also changed my ability to manage my emotions so I don't get hijacked. I do not allow my phone in the bedroom. I know the research. Deloitte just did a study based on phone use alone, and 33% of people are reading emails in the middle of the night. I know that if you go to bed and the phone is right next to you, right? So you go to bed because you need your phone. You know, somebody might need you and you sleep. You know, if this is right here and it's not closed and the blue light is on, they've done studies where they have people at a table and the researcher will put their phone on the table. Not even my phone, the researcher's phone, and the brain lights up like crazy just with the presence of a phone. The research around the phone and sleep is so stunning that if you were to adopt one radical thing today other than the 5-second rule, try putting your phone outside your bedroom. Turn off the so you don't hear it. Tell people who need to reach you to call you. My kids, I have a kid in college, a kid who's, you know, high school, kid in middle school. If there's an emergency, call me. There is nothing happening on your phone at 2 o'clock in the morning that's important. But if you allow yourself to become a tool of this, this is supposed to be your tool for selling, your tool for communicating, and we're all becoming the tool. Here's the other thing, common sense wise, that I want you to understand. You wake up, the alarm goes off. What do you do? Whoop! So you're not even vertical and you're reading emails. And what is in these emails? Other people's crap. If you don't have boundaries with this puppy, it's gonna impact sleep, it's gonna impact how much money you make, it's gonna impact how much self-control you have. And so when I put this thing outside the bedroom and I wake up, I walk over to where the phone is, it's plugged into my bathroom, I turn it off, I don't look at it yet. I give myself 5 minutes. 5 minutes before I tune into the world to actually tune in up here and say, what's the one thing I'm gonna get done today that really matters to me? If you're the kind of person that feels like you don't have control over your day gets hijacked, that you can't get to the priorities, that you're always behind the ball, this one planning thing will change your life. No phone in the bedroom, turn it off when the alarm goes off, 5 minutes, five lousy minutes before you tune into the rest of the world. And if you've got the kind of job where you've got to check it, get up 10 minutes earlier. You have control over this stuff, and it is so important that you take it seriously now, because you're living at the slowest moment of your entire life.
Because you made it this far in a video, I want to celebrate you. Most people start and don't finish. Most people never actually follow through. Most people say they want something, but they don't ever do the work to actually get it. But you're different. You are special. Believe Nation, you made it here all the way to the end, and I love you. So as a special celebration, if you put a hashtag Believe down in the comments below on this video, I will showcase you and celebrate you somewhere on the screen in a future video, because you are awesome. If you want the 7 habits to beat your procrastination, check the video right there next to me. I think you'll love it. Continue to believe, and I'll see you there.
I want you to stop dreaming, and I want you to just start doing small things. I want you to go back to curiosity and less into crushing your big goals. The thing about